Okay. Nobody likes talking about Jesus, okay? So we're going to talk about him. You refuse to be dictated to by negative considerations. First thing I have to say about Jesus is that, strangely enough, he was a Jew, without being an anti-Semite. Now, only Jews can appreciate that joke. Any person who is an anti-Semite is automatically antichrist. Will you please make a note of that in a very thick, heavy pencil? All anti-Semitism is anti-Christian. Then we're going to talk about this very peculiar fellow who was born roughly a couple of thousand years ago, give or take 4 years in a scholarly manner. We're going to talk about the principle behind the idea of a Messiah, of a human being who exists physically and yet mysteriously has a consciousness that is permeated with absolute wisdom. And we know lots of clever fellows on earth in various fields of science and philosophy, but we don't meet up with the omniscience. Or if we do, they keep it dark for their own purposes. There are two genealogies in the New Testament that are interesting, and they cause scholarly problems because there are two. And they're not identical, but they're not supposed to be. Any being that exists at all must have two sides, two poles. And these two poles are signified in the two different genealogies. Now, the statement made by Jesus about himself was that he fulfilled a prophecy that stated that God himself would appear on earth and would be embodied in a man, and that this man would be the Son of God directly. That is to say, not mediated merely through the time process, like the rest of humanity, but he would be able to commune at right angles, to use an analogy, to the time process. And this man, Jesus, claimed to be this very being, this Messiah. He himself said, "This day is it fulfilled, as it was foretold." So whatever anyone else thinks about him, he was fairly clear about what he thought about him. And what he thought about him was that he represented the goal of the human race, and that he was the first of human beings to manifest the attainment of that goal. And he laid down a method for other beings to attain the same goal. We know today, scientifically, that matter is energy. That energy is force, power, that can do work. And we know that matter is not made of solid, irreducible particles, as it was thought to be in the 19th century. We know we can reduce matter down to energy, and we know that all energy forms are interchangeable. We have to think about what that means. If all energy forms are interchangeable and matter is energy, then we can change the energy involved in a so-called material body into other forms. We can change that same energy into emotion. We can change that same energy into thinking. We can change that same energy into comprehending, understanding. We can change it into initiative. All forms of energy being interchangeable, it means that any form of energy that we know of can become any other form under the appropriate conditions. Now, this has been known in principle to be a possibility long before Jesus appeared on earth, and we find several thousand years before he arrived, evidences of a belief amongst ancient people that it was possible in principle for a will to exert itself upon a so-called material body, that the will could operate upon a mind, that the will could operate on the objects in the material world, on the thought processes in the human race, on the behavior of animals. The will is a power. The power, the force, the energy can be changed into any other form. Now this particular man, Jesus, had tremendous chutzpah. He said he was this goal man attained that had been foretold by the prophets. And he says that he is the only door to the attainment of the same condition. When he says, I am the door, he means precisely that nobody can get to this truth any other way. And that all who came before him were beginners. They were trying to get to it, but they didn't do it. And he says, he did it. He attained it. And he attained it by a process which finished up materially in crucifixion, and that this crucifixion was a precondition to a resurrection, and that the crucifixion was determined by him in his own time, and his resurrection was determined by him in his own time. He said, I lay my life down and I take it up again. He was claiming complete control over his organism. He was also claiming that any human being who would believe what he was saying and do what he recommended would attain the same status with himself. There would be sons of God like him in every respect except one. The one respect was that he did it first. Nobody could take away from him that he did it first, and that his having done it was a precondition to anyone else doing it. Now we know that Buddhism is pre-Christian. We know that the Mosaic dispensation is pre-Christian. We know that many great teachers existed and taught religious truths before him. But their truths did not find themselves gathered together in a human being in the same way that they did with him. If we take a man like Zarathustra, the founder of the Persian religion, we find, yes, his birthday is the same as Christ, 25th of December in our calendar, that there are many similarities about him, that he also is killed, persecuted, but we do not find in the story about him that he deliberately chose the course, that he deliberately took all the steps to determine his own crucifixion. He was attacked by the establishment, like Jesus was, but we do not find evidence that he was creating the conditions of his own capture. We do not find this deliberate recommendation to one of his own disciples to go and betray him. In the same way, we do not find in Buddhism that Buddha was crucified at all. He lived to be about 80 and died with a tummy ache. He taught an intellectual analysis of the universe and a method of breaking identification with the world so that you could escape from a cycle of birth, growth, old age, disease, death, rebirth. He taught reincarnation. But he taught this in an intellectual way. In fact, his name Buddha is from the same root that would mean in Sanskrit intellect. He was an intellectual of a very fine mind, highly developed intellect, but he had not reached the level of determining his own fight against the establishment. He was supported by the establishment. Princes gave him places to preach in. They recommended him to other people. They gave him parks and other places. They helped him to set up is groups of followers. So the establishment was very pro-Buddha, but the establishment was not pro-Jesus. Now, when we come to consider this very carefully, we find an essential difference between being clever, like Buddha was intellectually, living to be a ripe old age and teaching people how to develop, how to control the mind, how to make the intellect function perfectly, to the destruction of the desire for existence. He was very good at telling you how to give up life, the technique of giving up, how to see through the veil of illusion that is in the material world. But he lived to a ripe old age, and he did not fight the establishment. The other people who were crucified before Christ, and there were enough, did not choose to be so treated. They did not deliberately annoy the authorities. They did not escape at will when attempts were made to arrest them. They did not come back and re-annoy the establishment until there was a sufficient mass of public opinion to gather the emotive energies of a nation together, so that upon his crucifixion a mark was made in the human soul that had not been made before. And prior to him, the rule was, if a man is crucified, hung upon a tree, he is cursed. Cursed is every man that hangs upon a tree. It was automatic that if you were hanging on a tree in the ancient world, you were a criminal. But the whole of his behavior said there is no proof whatever that a man hanging on a tree is necessarily a criminal. He was a man who'd done nothing except tell truths to people, and who had warned the authorities that he would set fire, metaphorically, to their system. And he'd done nothing except help people to grow up, to mature, to become self-responsible. And yet he was hanging upon a tree. So instead of the tree, the cross, because they used to crucify people on trees, instead of that cross being a symbol of shame, through his act it became a symbol of victory. So that you could hear later on a short little statement, no cross, no crown. You cannot attain wholeness unless you are prepared to put yourself in the same position under the same conditions, or very similar conditions, to those that Christ put himself in. Now, this man, Jesus, said one interesting little thing about the children. He said, the children are like those members of the kingdom of heaven. And he said, their angels continuously face God. Now, some of you have seen a diagram, which is drawn by my young friend Andrew Freeman, of circles interlaced. And these circles have inside them, apparently, through the overlapping of other circles, a six-petaled flower. But the petals of this flower are simply an appearance caused by the intersection of other circles. So that no single circle has anything of its own other than the circle. But the content of the circle, the six petals, belong to the circles around that circle. And because there are six of those petals, which arise automatically from the geometry of the situation, therefore, we use the word for six. In Latin that would be sex, in Greek it is hex. And we call a circle with six petals in it a hexon. H-E-X-O-N, a hexon. Now, this hexon means exactly what you think you mean when you say, I exist. The word exist means to stand out from a background, because the being that is said to exist is a six sixfold being. That is to say, the structure of the being presupposes the intersection of circles. If there were only one circle, it would be void. But if you overlap that circle with other circles, you find geometrically that six exactly fit around the perimeter. And because it is six, the number six in all the major religions means existence. To exist was to be six. And sex, Latin for six, and sexuality is a means whereby existent beings continue to come into existence. To exist is to be six. And to be six is to be indebted to the six circles around any given one. Now, in case there are any people who haven't seen what we are talking about, I will draw a circle like this. I will put 6 points here. If I had the compasses, you would see that they would arise automatically. I draw the circle with the compass point there. I move it to the perimeter, and then I draw another circle like that. Then I move the compass to here and draw another circle like that. I move it to there and draw another circle like that. I move it to there and draw another one like that. I move it to there, draw another like that, and then I draw this one. Now you see, I have a six-petaled flower, a lotus of the yogis, in the middle of this circle. But you know, you saw me draw that. There is no such form there, really, is there? They're simply circles drawn round another circle, and there is something in ourselves, in our own consciousness, in our desire, in our will, that makes us tend to interpret it that there is a central circle with six petals. But you know that those petals do not belong to this circle. Each of the lines belongs to another circle outside it. And when we look at that diagram, we see that because we can draw this as we have, we could go on extending this diagram indefinitely. That means to say, there's no reason why I shouldn't draw again another circle here, and another here, and another here. Then I would have another six petal flower here. And you will see, when you look at the diagram, that your mind tends to flick to make a center here and a center there and to oscillate between them. Now, if we were to go on, we could cover the whole of this sheet of perspex. And if we had a big one, we could cover that. And if we had infinite time, we could cover that. Now, what is the meaning of this diagram in relation to the subject matter we are talking about? It is this. The diagram that we have made is made by pure logic. That is to say, we draw a circle, we just put the little prong of the compass onto the periphery, and we draw another, and we keep on doing this, and we find that the periphery has been cut into six parts, and there is now, apparently, a six-petaled flower in the middle of any circle that we care to draw. Obviously, there's another one here, isn't there? We find this same thing. Wherever we go, we're going to get this same problem. We can extend this to infinity. Now, the infinity of this pattern, infinitely extended in the fourth gospel, is called the Logos. The Logos, the word that is translated in English, the Word. In the beginning was the Word. In the beginning was the Logos. And the logos in Greek means not only word, it means ratio, proportion, truth. We can see that there is a necessary relation, necessary means unceasing relation, between all these circles, such that if we analyze one of the circles accurately, we have in principle analyzed all of them. Now think about that very carefully. If you are following this with your mind, you are able to say that your consciousness can actually see that to draw one of these circles and understand it gives you the power to draw another circle just like the first one. With a pair of compasses, this will be done accurately. Think about that, because your mind can see this to be true, can't it? Is there anyone here who can't see it to be true? Can I have a hand up for the person who can't see it to be true that if I walk around that circle with my compasses, I will have actually drawn another six-petal flower? Is there anybody who doubts it? Now, when we see a thing as clearly as this, we call it a self-evidence. The circle, with the six circles round it, is its own evidence of its own truth. It is a self-evidence. And we don't only call it a self-evidence, we also call it an immanent self-evidence, because it is internal to itself, the key to its own structure. Think of that very carefully. Internally to itself, it is the key to its own structure. So that if we understand thoroughly one of those existential beings standing out circled with its six petals, we have in principle understood every circle with its six petals throughout the whole infinite extent of space. Think of the essential simplicity of that. In one part of the Gospel it says, Christ knew what was in man. He knew what was in man. He didn't need to examine two men. One man, thoroughly analyzed, was all men. We know that because we all derive from human protoplasm. So there is in principle nothing in my friend Trevor that is not in my friend Gerhard. And it cannot be other than that. Whatever there is in the one circle, call that Trevor, and this one Gerhard, the slightly bent one here. Trevor's is perfect, as you see. Here's the affectionate way Trevor put his arm around Gerhard to comfort him for the deficiencies of being a bent circle. And you see, that shows the natural generosity of any hexon in the presence of a bent one. They're right, Trevor. Are you blushing a bit? A little, yes. Behind every arm gesture around someone is a slight tendency to feel superior, isn't it, Trevor? Will you please apologize to Gerhard for that? But actually, of course, Gerhard knows that Trevor's as bent as he is in other ways. Now, this infinitely extended field we call the hexonic field. In philosophy, it is called the eidetic. Do you want me to write eidetic? Say yes or no. Yes. I heard yes and no simultaneously, so I will write it at the same time. I will not write it. Yes? Eidetic and hexon, for those who can't spell. It's a nice hexon. Now, to say hexonic field and eidetic field is to say the same thing in two different ways. Philosophically, the eidetic field, this is from eidos, meaning form. Form, shape, structure. You can see that in our field here, shall I define a field? Do we all know what a field is? It is any area of influence of any conceivable kind. A field is an area or zone of influence. So that when we talk about a hexonic field, we mean an area in which the hexon structure is influential. It will condition us. If we look at this diagram, we see that already our eye is conditioned by the content. If I go outside this hexonic diagram and do this, like that, that is also a condition. Condition means I'm with, saying, together. I have put down a little shape there, and that little shape could symbolize a man in Chinese, especially a clever kind of man with his fingertips. And if we were to put a couple of hangers underneath there, that would mean he was a thief, because that refers to where you keep your stolen property under your armpits. Now, when you look at that, your consciousness, the field of your awareness, is influenced by the shape or form and made to contemplate certain things in a certain way, differently from the way you contemplate where the hexon is. Are we all quite clear that when we extend this diagram of the hexonic structure, the six-fold circles, each with six petals in, and all the petals belong not to the circle that's got them, but to the six surrounding that circle. So that no person with an internal structure has that internal structure from himself. His internal structure is the product of his relation with the totality of other beings. Now imagine that if you understood this diagram thoroughly, infinitely, you could draw any shape whatever. You could go over the lines that exist, you could thicken them up, select a bit, go over another piece. I think I'll take another color for this, show what I'm talking about a bit. On the basis of the hexonic diagram, I can go over, I can change my mind instead of going all the way around, and I can come along there, down there, and along there, and down there. I could make this shape without going off the lines. Now you see that if I make these circles very small and then super stress them, that is go over them with a different colored pencil, I can draw any shape whatever that consciousness can conceive. Not by producing anything new in the shape, but by selecting particular portions of that hexonic field to stress. That means to say that I could, by spreading these over the page and then looking at the person, super stress the lines and draw the portrait of a human being. It's rather laborious when you do it with compasses, but you can do it and get a perfect likeness of that person, because the person is already structured by that hexonic field. When the field is the zone of influence and the consideration, the hexon is the six-foldedness, and it is by reason of this six-foldedness that apparently there stands out from the background a six-petaled structure. So to stand out and to exist are synonyms. But it doesn't really stand out, does it? It stands out because we will it to stand out, to make a center to rest our consciousness upon it. Now it's perfectly obvious that this relatively simple piece of geometry, which is the foundation of all sciences, the foundation of all wisdom, all philosophy, from the most ancient times, when we go back into the temple initiatory processes, when we examine the greats of ancient philosophy, we find them saying, if you don't know any geometry, don't come to our school, because we want you to understand that your thought is form and that that form is structure created by the Kamsas. So that all the great philosophies are fundamentally geometrical, mathematical, and logical in base. But when we said those three terms, mathematics, geometry, and logic, we haven't mentioned something, namely our interest in them. We feel like it, or we do not feel like examining this proposition. The general feminine tendency is not to pay due respect to logic, mathematics, and geometry. The general tendency in a man is to pay very great attention to those three subjects. Those three subjects, understood by male minds, put men on the moon. Those three subjects have endangered the whole world with Polaris, with nuclear weapons, intercontinental ballistic missiles. They're all a product. The poltergeist knocking at the window wants to come in. They are all a product of mathematical science, built logically on geometrical considerations. So when we go back to the beginnings of time, we find the first consideration is geometry, logic, mathematics. And with those three subjects, all the inventions of the world have been made. Now, at some point in history, we know that the human race derives from a form of protoplasm which is not very complex, the amoeba. And we know that because of its lack of complexity, it cannot articulate a sentence and define for you what geometry and mathematics and logic mean. So if you want to know about those subjects, you don't go to an amoeba, you don't go down to the fish pond and fish a few out and talk to them. You go to the university and talk to a gentleman who is called Professor of Logic or Professor of Maths and so on. Now, the more complicated structure of the human being is the ground of his ability to discuss such problems. And we can see that unless a person were structured in this sixfold way, unless his own being were made of a circle with the six interlacing ones, he would not be able to comprehend or understand or manipulate this kind of thinking. But at some point in history, there must have been a first being who understood this principle perfectly and who mysteriously embodied it in his substance, who embodied it so completely that his whole being was permeated with the awareness of what that diagram means. And such a person would do so in a threefold way. He would understand it intellectually, what it means to be existent, what it means to stand out from a background. He would understand it in feeling and emotion. He would understand it in terms of volition, of will. So he would be like three circles, each with six petals in them. We will draw such a being fairly simply. There is the lower level, the tummy, there is the chest, there is the head, and there's a little break there. As Brother Stonehouse says, when you become a new man, you must make a clean break. There has to be a gap. Now, inside here, by our law, there must be six petals. And inside here, likewise, there must be six. And inside the head, also, there must be six. Did you notice how to do those in three different ways? You can draw them in an infinity of ways. Now, when we put that down, it is quite permissible for us to say shorthand, like that, 666. Now, if you read in the book of Revelation, you will find that it says the number of man and of the beast is 666. That is to say, he exists on three levels of awareness. He exists as a volitional being. He exists as a feeling being. He exists as a thinking being. And if he has that trinity of thought, feeling, and will, his number is 666. And it is quite correct for us to draw this in the form of a triangle. Again, a convenient method. And we could write 6 there, 6 there, and 6 there. You can actually find such little decorative pieces, ceramic or jewels, in the ancient world used as pendants. They were mnemonics to remind people about it. And on the one side here was put will, and on the other side there was put thought, and here was put action, which follows from the union of will, thought, conjunction. Will is power, thought is form. And when you put power onto form, the result is action. So if we let thought energies come down, they become likes and dislikes, feelings, emotions. And if we let those go down, then the legs that go out here start moving. We get action. Think carefully that if you have thorough awareness that you have nothing in your mind, no structure that hasn't got into it through the intersection with other beings, through relation with other beings, your mind has become structured. You have nothing in your feelings except that which has come into them through relation with other beings. You have nothing in your will except that which has come into it through relation with other beings. Think of that very carefully, and then say to yourself, who was the first man? Not to conceive the theoretical possibility of it. Plato had already done that, and others before him. The great Shankara in India knew it quite well. So did Omar Khayyam and others. But who was the first man to take this idea and actually embody it to the nth degree and arrange his own fixation? Now, you can't fixate something inside your consciousness without pushing it very hard. Are there any amateur piano players here tonight? Are there any people whose mothers thought they were budding geniuses on the violin and who bought them a wooden box and let them attack it with a horse's tail and the innards of a cat? Now, after a few hours trying the patience of the rest of the family, most of these potential geniuses give up, don't they? Most people had to go at something. But that most people have not persisted in that which they have had a go at. They haven't applied the Suzuki principle. And if you play the note wrong 5 million times, then play it 50 million times and it might come right. That's called the Suzuki principle. The rest of the family usually will not tolerate the extension of the exercise. But if the thing is to become embodied in your musculature, in your nervous system, in your glandular system, in every cell of your body, you must drive yourself to make that body obey the thought of it, that's your theoretical principle, the feeling that you would like to become it, and the action of repeated determination to embody it. Now, at some period in history, it follows that some being would become obsessed with the necessity of embodying this principle in this threefold way. Now, Orthodox Jewry thinks that that man has not yet arrived. Official Christianity thinks he has arrived. In either case, he was Jewish or will be. The essential thing is that he must be an affirmer of that operation. And what Jesus says is that he has actually done it, and he said, I will prove it because I will actually go to the nth degree of consistency. I will push and push and push my thought, and I will oppose the establishment of his day who deny the rights of individual free expression, and I will oppose them so well and so efficiently they will have to crucify me, and then, having been crucified, I will resurrect my body because I have control over it and because matter is only power. And power has all its forms interchangeable, and therefore I can lay my life down and I can take it up again. And he says he's going to do it, and he does do it as far as the cross. More or less everybody's agreed about that. And then his body is taken down, put in a tomb, and mysteriously vanishes, and then a man comes and talks to disciples, and they recognize him as the man who said he was going to do it. And from those primitive beginnings, Christianity developed. It lasted about 400 years and then collapsed. The reason it collapsed is because the work is very hard. But if you read the prologue in the Gospel of John, you will find that it states very clearly that you can do it if you fulfill the conditions. The conditions are that you must see that that logos, that exonic field that we had before, is an absolute truth, that you have nothing as individuals that is your own. Everything that you have is owed to the beings with whom you've been in relation. So you are not egotistically self-made. You are indebted absolutely to an infinity of predecessors, to an infinity of contemporaries, and to forces at levels of being that your physical egoic consciousness is totally unaware of. And this man Jesus says he has done it. And he says you too can do it in the same way. And he lays down one or two very simple rules. And the greatest of the rules that he lays down is turn the other cheek. That is to say, do not be reactive. And let's see why being reactive is the wrong way of approaching the problem. Here is a being. We're now doing an abstraction. Here is another being. And we write inside a letter called psi in there. Now this psi means a zone of contested influence. Here is the center of one circle, here is the center of the other. Either of these circles could contest for the dominion of this psi zone. Neither of them has any more right than the other to determine that he will dominate this contested zone. That might be Germany, that might be France, that might be Belgium. It might be that might be China, that might be America, that might be Vietnam. Always there is a contested zone. And as long as the two circles in the situation are determined to gain absolute dominion over that zone, the fight is interminable. And the solution to this problem of Jesus is very simple. Don't contest for that zone that properly belongs to neither of you. Give it up. Imagine what would happen. Here is a king, and this is his empire. Here is a king, this is his empire. But here is a contested zone. And this king starts ordering its about. If this one orders the same, you have a border incident and a war. If this one says, do you really wish to order this? Okay, I abdicate. Now this one has now to extend his dominion to include this area, because he's abdicated. His responsibility grows. Supposing he now encounters another circle like this. Again, another king, another center. Supposing this king here has abdicated and gone over there, formed a new center. This man here now extends his authority to that. Again, he comes up against this king, and this king abdicates again. And he keeps on abdicating. Doesn't it logically mean that this king here must become king of infinite universes, logically? Is not his responsibility increasing and increasing and increasing? Is it conceivable that a finitely identified being can have sufficient power to assume the responsibility for an infinite universe? Can we conceive it? We can't. So the question is, have we got the clarity of mind to recognize that when we abdicate the control over one of these contested zones, it merely throws bigger responsibility on the other fellow? And we can go and get him another studies in another zone that he hasn't yet reached. And this is what Christ is saying, turn the other cheek. He says it in various ways, that's the simplest way. If your brother wants you to go a mile, go two. In other words, accommodate yourself so efficiently to the other man's egotistic grab that his egotistic responsibilities are increasing and increasing, and yours are decreasing and decreasing. Let's compare that with Lao Tse's statement in the 6th century BC, daily deal with less and less. Every time you see a contest, a possibility of a war with somebody over a contested territory, you abandon the contest after a charming talk to the elephant. You'd really like to control this? Okay, I resign. You daily deal with less and less. But while you are dealing with less and less material, doesn't it follow that you are gaining by new territories? You keep walking to new places, don't you? Set up a new little kingdom there. He says, you've annexed my bit. So off you go again, you move to another place. Aren't you gaining more and more and more experience everywhere? Doesn't it follow that the breadth of your experience, of your understanding, is becoming more and more, faster and faster than that particular Herod fellow there is doing? Now this is the technique that Jesus recommends. He claims to be the first man to embody, not merely intellectually comprehend, but to embody in every cell in his body this principle, so that absolute truth vibrates in him, so that he knows the way of light. He knows the technique. He says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. He's got the method. And we know that in the 4th century, with Constantine, that message was suppressed officially, and that Christianity had an extraordinarily difficult battle and lost it progressively more and more, until the last Archbishop of Canterbury could say, we must reconcile ourselves to loss of numbers of Christians, and we'll have to try to make a qualitative improvement in the few who remain. There's a sort of winding up process going on in that once imperially extended religion, and a few people may comprehend what it is really about, and they would then become the elect of a new dispensation, and they would form a new kind of association, a new kind of church, and that church would have a principle which would necessarily be attacked by any establishment claiming authority over other beings, because any establishment claiming authority over other beings there necessarily is claiming a right to contest this zone and to subordinate all other circles to itself. When this claim is made by any establishment of absolute authority over all other circles, it is obviously illogical, because no finite can possibly dominate an infinity of those circles. No finite hexon has a content belonging to itself. Its content belongs to its relation of thought and feeling and will of all the beings it's ever encountered in its own life since birth, and protoplasmically in the ancestral life. So we know he's wrong, that the dictator in principle is wrong, and it doesn't matter how many millions of people he puts to death, he's still wrong, because there is a limit to the extension of his power, because he's a finite being. So we rest upon the fact fundamentally that he is wrong. Now, in that case, we can say, if we go to our hexonic situation here, if we keep on drawing the circles more and more, further and further out, there is always a zone beyond the circles that we have drawn in time, because in time we haven't got eternity to draw in, and therefore there must always be a zone outside the formulated zone that we call the hexonic field. And we use the word para, which is Greek and Sanskrit for beyond, so that we can talk about a para hexonic field outside the structure of that sixfold being. Para, beyond the hexon. Para hexonic field. Likewise, we know another kind of transcendence, para, a beyondness, not only a beyondness in space that way, but if we remember, isn't it true that I drew that diagram on a clear piece of perspex? It is also true that I can wash it off and it will vanish. So cannot we say, quite logically, that the sheet of perspex on which the drawing is made is likewise para? It itself is not conditioned by this hexonic pattern. It is para hexonic substance. Now, we've already said that matter is only power, so the concept of substance can only mean power. So if we talk about para hexonic substance, we are talking about infinite power. Think about that very carefully. When we talk about matter, we're talking about the behavior of energy, force, or power. When we remember that the sheet of perspex is called material, but is really a modality, a behavior, a structure of power, of energy, of force, then we know that the substance of this piece of perspex is power. And because we can wash off the hexon and reveal once more the perspex underneath it, so in the same way we can wash away the whole structure of the universe and leave the power, and that power is called para hexonic ultimate reality. We wash away the whole structure just like that. Now, when we wash it away like that, we say we have solved, salvated, given it salvation. We've released it from the rigidity of its structure by simply spitting on it and rubbing it a bit. Salvation means washing away the structures that we don't want, the structures of mind, of feeling and will that are a nuisance to us. Salvation means wash it away. It doesn't have any other meaning. Wash away an erroneous idea, wash away a wrong feeling, wash away bad will, and that is salvation. Therefore, we can say, we can make for ourselves a union of beings who understand this principle, and the Greek for church, ecclesia, is the gathering together, the meeting of, in loose association with total respect for individual freedom, all those who comprehend the meaning of this diagram, the meaning of the logic of it, the meaning of the geometry, the meaning of the mathematics, and the feeling of absolute interpenetration, absolute mutual interdependency. And any person who thoroughly understands that diagram in its three aspects, who thoroughly understands that he is one of those 666 fellows, is an automatic member of the Ecclesia para hexon. Simply to understand it is to immediately qualify for membership of that Ecclesia. We are having a free discussion. I will ask my kind-hearted fellow here, this sympathetic fellow Trevor. Trevor, do you yourself understand, I put this to you, this diagram here, that this signifies that in your will you are indebted to the wills of your parents, to the wills of all the people you've ever encountered, for the clarification of your own will? That you can't do it from yourself. You're sure about that, aren't you? It's not a matter of opinion, is it? No, it's a matter of self-evidence. In the same way, any emotions that you've had, have they not arisen in you in relation with some other persons?
Always.
And that's not a matter of opinion, it's a matter of observed fact. And any thought you've had in the whole of your life, since you were taught your ABC, has that thought arisen in you through interrelations with the thought processes of other beings? It cannot be in any other way. And when you see that, you are seeing a self-evidence, aren't you? Which makes you a 666 being, doesn't it? And therefore, understanding that principle, you are an automatic member of the Ecclesia para hexon, aren't you? By definition. Now, this does not mean that you haven't got some inertias to overcome. It doesn't mean that if somebody insults you, you might not blush. It doesn't mean if somebody kicks you on the shin, you might tend to withdraw your leg. But it does mean that when you thoroughly understand it, you will know why that reaction occurs. And you then are in the position of being able to do something about it in a way that you couldn't do before you understood that proposition. Because you could not egotistically say, that is my idea, not yours, could you, to anybody? Neither could you say that feeling for the Beethoven Ninth is mine, not yours. You haven't got a feeling for anything that is not totally the product of total human evolution to date and the total structure of the universe. Now then comes the big question. Do you like the idea? Just about. Just about, right. Now if you just about, have you got 51% of the shares for it?
Yes.
Yes. Now when you do that, it doesn't make you immediately comfortable because you know there's a lot of work to be done. But it does say you prefer to be a member of that understanding level of being. Now it is possible that some men would say, I don't like it. We can conceive it, can't we? Now if we find a man who is like that, he would use the same 666, wouldn't he? But he would have demoted himself to the level of beast, because he would have denied the universal application of this truth You would have said, yes, I've got 6 parts, but they're mine, in the will. I've got 6 parts in the feeling, they're mine. I've got 6 parts in the thought, they're mine, they are not yours. He would immediately dehumanize himself, and he would be a beast. He would be 666, but he wouldn't be a human being anymore, because he would have cut himself off from the infinity of benefits of the recognition of the reciprocal interrelation with all beings.
Yet the sun would continue to shine.
He wouldn't stop it by his disbelief. And it would be shining on him. He might even be becoming melanized a bit by his action and shouting, this sunburn is mine. It has nothing to do with the sun. I make this lovely black colour on my feet.
Doesn't it leave the door all stiff before he's checked?
Kind-hearted Trevor again. Yes, the door is always open. But there is a very peculiar thing about the human ego. When it writes its name on something and declares itself to be a beast 666, the inertia of its repetition of it makes it progressively harder and harder and harder to come out of the identification and embrace the ecclesia para exon. Can you see that? Inertia. You make your mind up, you stand on a certain point, and you say, I'm going to stand on this. You raise your comb, you stand on top of your private dunghill, you crow, and then somebody says, quite wrong. Do you mean to say sorry about that? Climb down without blushing. Or do you start throwing Indian corn about? Yes. The tendency is to defend a known untrue position, is it not? To save face. But if you do that, are you not dehumanizing? Aren't you placing yourself in the category beast? Because lo, your breath goes down to the ground, even as the beast. If you say you're a separate entity, in no way indebted to other beings, have you not alienated yourself from other beings? And isn't that self-evident? And so it says in the Revelation, 666 is the number of a man and of a beast. All depends on the orientation. Do you orientate to the infinite, reciprocal interpenetration of energies of thought, to feeling and will? Or do you say, no, I dislike it, and I will not have it. I am myself, self-made, a true, solid Yorkshire businessman, totally non-indebted to anybody. My brain is my own creation. I have done my own perceiving. I have cultivated Pelmanism. I can remember 20 articles randomly structured at will. I am self-made. Now the man that says that is a beast. That is to say, his understanding is falling down below the level of humanity, isn't it? Now there must have been a first man who made this clear, and we cannot usurp his position of being first. We can learn all he's got to teach, but we cannot be first, can we? And therefore he's called the only begotten, the onely begotten, the one who saw this proposition and then embodied it inside his very substance, so that evermore, not just in time for a few thousand years, but for eternity, nobody can take away that he did it first. Nobody could take away from Lao Tse that he said valleys collect fertile soil better than bare mountain peaks. Nobody could take away from Buddha that he said the way to get out of life is give up the thirst for life. But nobody can take away from Jesus that he substantially embodied the true significance of the hexonic interrelations, that he is the head of the ecclesia para hexon, and that in all eternity, in future and past, that truth cannot be altered. It doesn't matter how many millions of people disagree or kick or misunderstand him. The fact is that he did it, that he died for it, that he put himself on the spot for it, and that he then mysteriously appeared again and then vanished and left such a mark in the human race that he became a controversial figure for all time. He makes a permanent mark in universal substance, and he is the head of that ecclesia. Anybody who likes to belong to that ecclesia and understands that elementary principle, which is very simple really, isn't it? A circle has six round it. What could be simple with a pair of compasses to demonstrate? Nothing. A little kiddie can understand it. I've drawn it many times to little boys and given them a pair of compasses, and they have drawn it. And they understand that it must be so. It is self-evident. And yet that simple statement is the basis of the total structure of universal possible knowledges. And you can either like it or dislike it. If you like it, automatically you are a true evaluator. Man means evaluator. And if you don't like it, you're on the way down again. Beast. You'd still be a 666, but you'd be a negative 666 if you don't like it, because you will degenerate. But if you do like it, you cannot help improving, because as your reciprocity with other people becomes more conscious, so you are able to give way in idea, in feeling, in will. You are able to accommodate yourself. And any good biologist studying survival will tell you that accommodation to the world situation is the same thing as survival. Where you can't accommodate, you perish. Where you can accommodate, you survive. A lot of people are thinking about digging holes in the ground and hiding in the not far distant future from radioactive clouds. Hiding. That's one kind of adjustment. Go underground. Others are thinking, maybe we can get used to it. Maybe we can tolerate it. This is an interesting little proposition. According to the prophecy, there will be some being on the surface, and there will be another being below the surface, like that. And the one below the surface, we will call him Sub. On. On means a being. He's an underbeing, and the one on the top we call Sur. On. Sur is the same as Surya, the sun. This one likes the sun. He likes light. You give him an opportunity to go in an arid shelter and stay there permanently, he'd prefer to run the hazards of the air. And if he exposes himself to the conditions of surface life, he will adjust. His body will change, his mind will change. If he is positive, he would be able to tolerate radiation doses, which the man hiding underground could not. And so the man underground would be like the beast. And in that prophecy, this beast is going to be chained below ground for a period of time. Whilst the other being on the surface, the Sauron, is going to be adjusting himself to the reality. This one will breed children with his fair spouse, who will have very, very, very high tolerance of the conditions above the surface of the ground. Down below, they will have low tolerance of surface conditions, and they'll build themselves a city below ground. Now, again, whenever we get an opposition of this kind, we choose. And we choose whether we'll be Saurons, appreciators of the sun's healing power, or whether we will go below and hide till the thing is over and cleared up. We're not under immediate pressure to make that choice in that situation, but we are under immediate pressure about whether or not we believe that the reciprocal interpenetration of human beings' energies is a reality or not. We are bound at any given moment to choose whether we believe we are individually isolated from each other, or whether we will admit and see and confess to ourselves that we have no isolation, that we are all in it together, reciprocally interpenetrating thoughts, feelings, and will. And that choice is always made now. It cannot be made any other time. If you don't do this now, you might do it in the middle of the night, in a new now. But you can never make it yesterday or tomorrow. But in any given moment, you choose to prefer that reciprocal interpenetration of forces of thought and feeling and will, or you reject it and say, I don't like people's minds interpenetrating my mind. I don't like people's emotions infecting me. See that horrible fellow Heifetz? He plays a violin with feeling, and he imposes feeling on me when he plays the violin. I refuse it. I hate it. It disturbs me. And the fellow who says that about Heifetz on his fiddle is a beast. And anybody who chooses not to be moved by the art of another being, by the science of another being, by the action of another being, demotes himself from the human level. Now, Jesus is the first historical figure that we know of, a very energetic young Jewish fellow with terrific chutzpah to go into the synagogue and say, this day is it fulfilled, in the presence of the establishment of the powers of the state and the church of his day, and to dare to do it and periodically vanish away when they tried to arrest him, until he'd got a big enough audience to justify the spectacle of the innocent man self-crucified. He and he alone has done it in the past, and nobody in the future can do it and be first. You can do it second. We had plenty of that, doing it after he did, during the great persecutions in Rome, in the arenas. Anybody can sacrifice themselves once they've seen it's profitable because another man has done it. But the first person to do it, now he is a very, very peculiar fellow. Now, there's been a lot of writing about a Gethsemane, a process in which he argued with himself, in which he meditated on whether it was worth it or not. And the accounts of that Gethsemane struggle inside Jesus generally place it that he is worrying about himself and his sufferings, and whether he should ask God to let him off the hook. And he comes out and says that he will do it God's way, not his. Thy will, not mine. But has he been worrying about himself, or has he been worrying about something else? The story tells you very clearly. He had some disciples with him, and he put them in a place and said, I will go away a little distance. I will meditate on the task that I have to fulfill. You stay here and watch. And he comes back to look at them, and they've fallen asleep. He goes back again. See? Watch. He comes and has another look. They've fallen asleep again. Can you see? He's not worried about him. He knows himself. He knows what he knows. He knows what 666 means. He knows what it means to be the head of the Ecclesia Paraexon. But unfortunately, his best hand-picked disciples fall asleep. Can he guarantee that when he's been crucified, that they will not fall asleep? They can't even stay awake in his presence. Will they be awake 2,000 years later? Or will they have fallen asleep? This is what his Gethsemane is about. Is there anyone in his day worthy of being his disciple? And it lists one out of the 12 chosen. And there is speculation that one may have been the John of the fourth gospel. There was a disciple whom Jesus loved. A disciple that put his head on Christ's breast. But as for the rest of them, they are going to represent this new truth, and already they're falling asleep. Already they're contesting for power. To say to him, can we have the best seats on your right and left hand when you come into your heavenly kingdom? And he says to them, can you suffer what I am going to suffer? And they say, yes, Lord, without bothering to inquire what it is. Certainly, if it means seats on the right and left. So he says, nevertheless, those seats are already booked. And we see juggling for power amongst the disciples while they're alive. And we see juggling for power amongst the first converts to the first Jewish disciples. We see a great battle between the followers of Peter and the followers of Paul. And it looks as if possibly the crucifixion, the demonstration, has been a total waste of time. Now think about that in Gethsemane. That Jesus is not worrying about Jesus. He knows he can do it. He can keep awake. He can crucify himself. But can his disciples comprehend what he's talking about? And if they do have a shadow of a glimpse of the meaning that he's giving to them, can they stay awake and can they apply it and will they endure? It is a risk. It is a risk because it is a matter of a will inside each of those circles whether or not that zone shall say yes, I believe in this reciprocal interrelation, or no, I find it very painful. It is a matter ultimately of will, and therefore there can be no absolute certainty that any of his disciples are going to endure long enough. And yet he has to do this demonstration because he knows if he doesn't do it, someone will have to do it, and if they don't do it, someone will have to do it. And either it never gets done, because it is a matter of will, or someone has to elect himself to do it. And the self-election of that Jesus to be the man who would accept the imposition of the implications of the knowledge of that para-hexonic intelligence, the self-imposition that he says, I will do the will of my Father. Not I am passive to the will of my Father. What I see this para-hexonic, this Father in heaven do in secret, that I will do openly. He takes this sense of I. He stands up. He becomes axial to the whole of the human race. A figure of scorn, figure of ridicule, a figure of controversy. But a figure that they cannot put down and cannot let go. He elects himself to be the one that will do it in the flesh, to the nth degree, to the cross, to the burial, to the resurrection, to the transcendence, the transfiguration, self-election. And then he says to every one of the human race who will elect themselves to believe in this, to believe that it has been done, which gives you the morale, the power, the positivity to say, he's done it, he's cleared the way, I can do it. I too can believe in reciprocity. I can believe in the interpenetration of thought. I can believe in the total indebtedness of all of us to all of us. And having believed that, I will now proceed to interrelate as much as possible. And I will apply all that is signified by the Sermon on the Mount, and by turn the other cheek, and by go 2 miles for one, by saying, if a man steals your overcoat, give him your undercoat, and if he steals your shirt, give him your pants. Whatever it is, I can apply it, and I will apply it. And I do not care what happens in the application, because I know that the people that can't do it are subhuman. They are the beast that is described in the Revelation. Now, anyone is free to think about it, free to like it or dislike it, and free to say, I prefer it, or I do not prefer it. To prefer it is already the beginning of the opening of the door. To begin to dare to try to act upon it, even in the littlest way, perfection is made of trifles, and perfection is no trifle, to give away a little bit in an argument, to give a point of logic to a man who's beaten you, and not say, well, I didn't mean that, I meant this. The ability to give way, to let the contested zone be ruled by the other man, even in little, to give your seat in a restaurant to somebody who was 2 seconds behind you and the place is crowded, a little triviality like that. But out of those trivialities builds up gradually the strength for the ultimate reciprocal interpenetration, which lifts you away from the earth, away from that beast 666, to turn over, to rotate on that great Sukhanta, to become the man 666, who evaluates on his three levels total reality. Now, we're going to say a final funny thing about this Jesus. Because he did it, we have to say that if we say here is a plane through reality, and we cover this with circles, all interpenetrating like this, I'm scribbling them to save time, but I could fill them all up with 6 petals. If I imagine that's a sheet of rubber, and I put my pencil in there and stretch it, I can press one of those circles down, like that, with my pencil, and I can find, by doing another one, I have created a condition across here of apparent alienation. But up here, there is absolute reciprocal interpenetration. So although by condensing our energies into the forms physical bodies, we are alienated, so it appears that Trevor is over there and I'm over here, at the hexonic level it is not true. The fields of Trevor's energies, the zones of influence, extend to here, and the fields here extend to there. And we call this level up here heaven, as well as hexonic field. And we can then see what Paul meant when he said, our conversation is in heaven. That is to say, we can lift up our intelligence, physical body, life field, mentation, serial thinking process, comprehension, volition, hexon. At the level of the hexonic field, the level we call heaven, at that level, our minds, our hearts, our wills are reciprocally interpenetrating. We are conversing in heaven, our conversation. We are with together turning there, even though Trevor is over there, as to the physical body's condensation, and I am over here, I know that Trevor is agreeing with what I'm saying, about this problem, and I know that Trevor, in committing himself 51% of the shares, was not joking, that he actually likes this reciprocal relationship idea. I know he's nervous of some of the implications. I know he's aware of the inertias of possible loss of temper under heavy stimulation, but I know he prefers it. Therefore I can say Trevor is a co-member of the Ecclesia Para Hixon, because he knows perfectly well that those circles have been drawn upon this perspex, and he knows that the power that drew them can wipe them out so that we can see the perspex clearly. In the revelation there it says, and there will be sea no more. All the differences will be washed away. This apparent separation of physicality is a lie, because if we get the appropriate electrical instruments even today, we can actually measure a field of force between Trevor and myself, between Trevor and Gerhardt, between Gerhardt and myself, and that field of force will reveal an electromagnetic relationship between us that differs in each case. So we're all uniquely related and interpenetrated at energy levels, whilst apparently at the gross physical level we are separate beings. Now think that when Jesus, the man of Nazareth, has a physical body there as a little baby, and a naughty fellow called Herod tries to kill it, and the parents remove it over there to Egypt, and then it comes back again having had some experiences, that Jesus has been precipitated spirally like this, so that already the potential of the work he is going to do is embodied in him through the genealogies on both sides. The continuous training over generations for the man who can do it has predisposed the protoplasm of this child sensitively to be aware of this hexonic field, to be aware of it so intensely that he will do it. He won't just think about it, he will do it. And so he comes down here into the time process, and he shakes the foundations of the Herod world and the beast world by the intensity of his dedication. And as we call this para zone, the beyond the hexon here, you observe there, para, pa means the father, ra means the son. This radiation function, this pi ratio coming down here, posits itself in the physical body of Jesus. Pa has put the ra in here, the name of the son at the zenith. It comes down here and embodies itself. And so great is the power and energy of that man that the whole world begins to shake like this. And the Herods, even when he's a baby, that is the men who divide power amongst themselves, shake. And they want to locate him before he gets any stronger. And they want to kill him, because they know, according to prophecy, that there is an inevitable development in the human race of the awareness of the uniqueness of the individual, such that at some point there must arise a man who is able to oppose the establishment and rock it to its foundations, so that it will never again have the authority that it had in the ancient world. In the ancient world, a king could put a crown on and say God had crowned him. Today, a king cannot do that. Today we have students all over the world in a state of individual unrest. The one thing they're absolutely certain they're not going to do is become cogs in the machinery of the establishment's mechanistic plan. They have another scheme, an intelligent survival scheme, and they're all studying it all over the world. How can we survive intelligently in reciprocal interrelations instead of going under the thumb of an establishment in any country that has absolutely no regard whatever for the reciprocal penetration, the interrelation of beings, but thinks at the oligarchical level that it has the right and the might to subordinate millions of people to the will of a handful. Now he brings that concept down, he embodies it in the crucifixion, he shakes the foundations. It's not surprising that the collective energies of the human race, shaking with the energy from the hexonic level, vest themselves in the earth, and there are earthquakes and queer behaviors in nature, because there has come down from there something that can't come down twice for the first time. He comes down once for the first time, shakes the foundations, and evermore the old idols have fallen. We can't put them back. Nobody can put the old idols back again. They've fallen down. And there is in the human soul now a deep awareness of individual, personal right to be present, to stand inside one's own being, not to be enslaved by the tyranny of large architecture, impositions of pyramids, of sphinxes, of temples, not to be intimidated by a cathedral into feeling meager, but to stand in one's own being, to be immanent in one's own consciousness, and to say, I do not care for the Herod tricks and the external destruction of separative intentions of the beast, because I know that the ultimate victory belongs to the Para, was laid from before the foundation of this world and assured absolutely. And in that absolute surety of that conviction, in any individual there is a debt, absolute, not a debt of a few years, not a debt owed to a man 2,000 years ago, a million idea, a debt that is absolute and stretches backwards, changing the course of history and the interpretation of it, stretching forwards into an endless future of absolute continuous indebtedness to the being that came down from that hexonic level and posited itself in the time process. Contemplating that, you can choose whether you like him or not, whether you prefer him as a companion, because he is a companion, because our physical bodies are modalities of this hexonic field, and his intelligence is permeating our mind. And we have immediate access to him in the center of our own motivation. We can say in our innermost center, I like this fellow, I like his idea, and I would prefer, God help me, to embody it to the intensity he did. So help me. And in saying that, the hexonic level of awareness begins to permeate the being. Courage appears in that being, and that being is no longer an egotistic slave to the time process. He is no longer Tim, that means time, form, timid. Timidity is gone, because he knows he's an eternal being, and he knows he's a permanent member of the Ecclesia Para Hexon, and he knows it doesn't matter if they shoot him and destroy his physical body, because he belongs here anyway, and if they get rid of him, he can return.